You are listening to WPVMLP in Asheville, North Carolina. 103.7 on the dial, heard globally on WPVMFM.org and on Alexa. Just tell Alexa to play WPVM Radio.
This is A Better World, coming to you from the studios of WPVM 103.7 FM in Asheville, North Carolina. And we're streaming live at WPVMFM.org. My name is McNair Ezard, and I'm your host for A Better World. Each week, we take an in-depth look at the people and organizations locally, nationally, and internationally who are working to create a world that works for everyone. And our guest today is Daniel Horan. Daniel is professor of philosophy, religious studies, and theology at St. Mary's College in Notre Dame. He's a frequent lecturer and retreat director around the United States and abroad, and has previously taught at Siena College, St. Bonaventure University, Catholic Theological Union, and other universities. Daniel is also co-host of the Francis Effect podcast. He's a columnist for the National Catholic Reporter and the author of more than a dozen books, including Engaging Thomas Merton, Spirituality, Justice, and Racism. His latest book is titled Fear and Faith, Hope and Wholeness in a Fractured World. Daniel Horan, welcome to A Better World.
Thank you. It's great to be with you.
Dan is here to talk about the life and work of Thomas Merton. But before we get into looking at Thomas Merton, can you tell us about yourself and your religious, spiritual, educational journey?
Sure, I'd be happy to. So I'm what we call in our religious tradition a cradle Catholic. I was born and raised in the Roman Catholic Church, went to Catholic schools my whole life up into actually through graduate school. And actually, for a period of time, was a member of a Catholic religious order. So for 20 years, I was a member of the Franciscan Order, founded by St. Francis of Assisi 800 years ago. And I was an ordained Catholic priest as well. And after 20 years of ministry and religious life, went through a process of spiritual discernment and reflection and dialogue with my community, and ultimately decided that God was leading me to a new chapter in my life and in my spiritual journey. And so about 2 years ago, formally decided to leave ministry, sort of retire from active ministry. I always like to think, you know, the military members of our service, you know, they can retire after 20 years and do another career, another chapter in life. And so in that way, it's, you know, maybe 20 years of service in the church in this way has been a gift of sorts. And now I'm using, you know, the gift and grace that God provides to do some other things in this world, including continuing to teach and to research and to write.
What primarily do you teach at the university?
So I teach both, as you mentioned in your very kind introduction, philosophy and theology. So this semester, for example, I'm teaching a few sections of philosophy of religion, which is looking at some of these fundamental questions of meaning, meaning-making, transcendence, questions of life and death, questions of the existence of God from a philosophical perspective. So what can we know? What can we ascertain through reason alone? And that gets the students thinking, you know, really outside the box sometimes and really imaginative and creative ways. But I also teach courses in theology. So at the Catholic University where I teach, St. Mary's, I teach a range of courses, including, I'm just thinking of a course I'm teaching this upcoming fall on environmental sustainability and theology. So I have a great interest in eco-spirituality and theologies of creation. So I find myself drawn to those sorts of themes and courses. I also teach a course in Catholic social thought, which is a really important tradition and something that in the news these days has come up quite a bit when we look at the issues of war and peace, about whether or not military action by a sovereign state could be called just in a moral sense. And without getting into the details, I'm sure listeners will recall a certain world leader is having a certain tiff with the Bishop of Rome, with the Pope, about these kinds of questions. So these are hot topics, but they're deep and profound and meaningful subjects to engage.
What do you find in your in your academic work and your as a professor, the openness to social issues and theology among your students?
I find that they come from a range of backgrounds. And, you know, as you might expect, if you have a classroom of 25 students, you're going to have 25 perspectives. And they tend to kind of group themselves unwittingly into three categories. There's one group of students that tends to be kind of overtly religious. So they may be raised in mainline Protestant traditions. They may have been raised in the Catholic Church or some other, oftentimes Christian traditions. Here in the Midwest, that's most common, but we have Jewish students and Muslim students and students of no faith at all. Then you have a sort of group of students who, regardless of how they were raised, find themselves in a position where they do not identify with the religious tradition. And so this is oftentimes described in popular media as the nuns, the N-O-N-E-S, and I encounter many of those in my classroom. And then there's this sort of movable middle, we might say, which is students who maybe don't think very much about religion or issues of transcendence or spirituality, but are open and interested, find themselves intrigued by questions that surface in the classroom. So I actually taught a course last fall for our first-year students, a first-year seminar, and the title of the course was, Can You Be Spiritual Without Being Religious? And we looked at this question, what is spirituality, and tried to come up with a few definitions and drew from different experts and scholars on the subject, and then explored Christianity, Judaism, Islam, and then this emerging field known as secular spirituality to see what was similar and different, how people approach spiritual practices, think of themselves in relationship to the universe, and how they form meaning in this world. And all three of those kinds of groups of students really engaged with these questions, with the material. And it was one of my favorite courses so far this year. And so I look forward to teaching it again.
You find that students these days are more or less ecumenically minded towards not only different denominations within the Christian faith, but also towards other faiths?
You know, it's something that I would hesitate to make a generalization. You know, this is easy to do based on sort of small sample sizes. What I have found personally is that the vast majority of young adults today are much more open to diversity in all sorts of categories. So diversity in experience, diversity in race or ethnicity, diversity in family of origin and class differences. And I think that extends as well to religious belonging. I think that, you know, this openness to, well, let me put it this way. In a course like Can You Be Spiritual Without Being Religious, there'll be a certain kind of self-selection among the prospective students in a class like that. But I find that even those who have a strong resistance to institutional religious belonging of any kind, nevertheless, were able to hold space for their classmates who were overtly religious, who may be kind of traditionally religious. And so in that regard, I would see an openness to dialogue, an openness to learning. We talked about really important and meaningful issues, sometimes current issues in a course like that. And one might imagine that there would be some hostility or defensiveness or pushback, but even when students disagreed, they did so with respect and care. And so I really appreciate that. I hope that's a sign of something larger, but maybe it's just in a group of 20 students I was privileged to encounter in that one semester.
That's good news to hear, and especially in light of what we hear mostly in the news these days about separation and division. So let me ask you, there might be some folks who are listening who don't know who Thomas Merton is. Can you kind of give us an overall picture of who he was?
I'd be happy to. Let's see if I can do this in a brief radio amount of time. So Thomas Merton is probably one of the most prolific and influential Christian spiritual writers of the 20th century. He was born in France in 1915 to an American mother and a father who was originally from New Zealand. His parents were artists, and so they were sort of free spirits. They traveled quite a bit, lived in parts of France, lived in England, moved to the United States when Merton was a young boy. His mother died when he was 6 years old, and 10 years later, when Merton was just 16, his father died, both of cancer, different types, a decade apart. Jumping ahead to the end of Merton's life, and I'll fill in some of the middle in just a moment, he dies at the young age of 53. He dies in 1968 while traveling to Asia to speak to Catholic and Buddhist monks about contemplation and monasticism. So he was raised, as I mentioned, by these artist, free spirit parents who were not especially religious. And so Merton grew up with a kind of skepticism, almost an antagonism toward organized religion. He spent his, what we would call in the States, his high school years, his secondary education in a boarding school in England, run that was, you know, nominally Anglican, still at that point did not identify with a particular religious tradition. He goes to college at Cambridge, earns a scholarship there, but really has a disastrous time, doesn't go to classes, parties, has a number of affairs, romantic affairs, and ends up losing a scholarship and going to live with his grandparents in Long Island, New York, where he studied at Columbia University and seems to have balanced his life out just a little bit. I always like to point out to my students when I talk about Merton's early life, when you get a scholarship to Cambridge, you fail out of that, and your safety school is Columbia University in New York, you know you're a smart kid. So he was certainly that. Loved to write. He was a poet, somebody who was involved in the literary scene in Columbia and in New York City in the 1930s. Some of his best friends went on to be very prestigious literary figures in their own right. People like the great poet Robert Lax was one of his best friends. He had artist friends like Ed Reinhart. One of his would become a lifelong friend and editor, Bob Giroux, who many listeners may recognize the name Giroux from the big publishing house Farrar, Straus and Giroux. I could go on and on. He was there at a really generative time. His aim, his desire was to be a novelist, a great novelist and poet. But near the end of his undergraduate studies, he took a course in philosophy that was taught by an instructor named Dan Walsh, who was a Catholic and taught sort of Thomas Aquinas and these great medieval thinkers, philosophers, and theologians. And it was the real first time that Merton started to see a sort of intellectual depth to religion and saw that Christianity and Catholic Christianity in particular was something that was not anti-intellectual, that wasn't something that was, as kids today would say, woo-woo, as he might have felt in his earlier years in his youth. Long story short there, he ends up discerning that he wanted to become a Christian. He wanted to join the Catholic Church and was baptized in November 1938, and shortly thereafter began discerning a call to religious life. He thought maybe God was calling him to be a member of a religious order and a Catholic priest. He explored a couple different communities, but ultimately ended up, after teaching for a few semesters at St. Bonaventure University in Western New York, he joined the Trappist Order, which is a reformed version of the Benedictine community at the Abbey of Gethsemane, just outside Louisville, Kentucky. And so he entered in 1941 on December 10th, and he lived there for 27 years, leaving very rarely. It wasn't until, as I mentioned, 1968, that he got permission to travel to Asia at the invitation of these monks over there to lecture about spirituality and monasticism and mysticism and interreligious dialogue, and died very tragically of an accident on the morning of December 10th, 1968. So the same anniversary day of his entering the monastery, coincidentally, he would die by accident. And he was deeply prolific, incredibly prolific, in fact, you know, counting also the books published posthumously, he was the author of 70 books, tens of thousands of pages of correspondence with all kinds of people from around the world. He continued to write poetry. He engaged in Zen calligraphy, so he was an artist. He was interested in Zen photography. He was interested in Eastern spiritual and philosophical traditions, interested in ecumenical conversation, which was really striking when you think about the state of religious affairs, especially in the Catholic Church before the Second Vatican Council. So he was really on the cutting edge of dialogue, of promoting meditation and contemplation and spiritual reflection for the masses and not just for the religious professionals like ministers or monks. And so really an extraordinary figure. As you can tell, I could keep going, and I know we're going to continue to talk about him. But I think in a nutshell, that's, you know, his life, a very short life of 53 years, but a life that was really full to the brim with energy and insight and spiritual wisdom.
If you just joined us, you're listening to a conversation with Daniel Horan, professor of philosophy, religious studies, and theology at St. Mary's College. And he's also author of over a dozen books, including Engaging Thomas Merton, Spirituality, Justice, and Racism. And he's with us today to talk about Thomas Merton. And you're listening to us at 103.7 WPVM in Asheville, North Carolina. Okay, that's the Oboe Concerto in D minor by Bach, and the album is Bach from Italy. Dan, unlike a lot of Christian hermits, say in the Eastern Orthodox tradition and similarly oriented individuals in Hinduism and Buddhism, Merton didn't think that the contemplative life meant he was exempt from what went on in the world. Was this an understanding that developed for him over time, or was it like in the 60s when he started writing more about social issues?
That's a really great question. I would actually say it's a both and situation. It was something that grew in him, that developed over time through his own prayer practices of contemplation, of praying the Psalms as monks do, you know, throughout the day. But also his dialogue with all kinds of people through correspondence, written correspondence, through guests that he would welcome and meet with at the Abbey of Gethsemane in Kentucky. But there were some pivotal moments. Famously, in 1958, he's in downtown Louisville, out running some errands, maybe going to the doctor, that sort of thing, the kind of thing that would bring a monk out of the cloister into the big city for an afternoon. And he has what Merton scholars oftentimes call an epiphany at the intersection of 4th Street and Walnut Street in downtown Louisville. In fact, there's a plaque there, a historical plaque there, if you're ever in Louisville on 4th, and now it's Muhammad Ali Street. Walnut's been renamed Muhammad Ali after another famous Louisville resident. And there he has this kind of awakening, this mystical experience where people are just going about their ordinary day, you know, mothers and children running errands, people going to the bank, you know, folks going to the doctor or to the pharmacy, and they're just going about their business. And Merton's standing at this intersection, seeing this sort of ordinary business, and says, you know, it's as if all these people are walking around shining like the sun. He says, I have this sense of connectedness. And he, in his journal and then later in the book Conjectures of a Guilty Bystander, elaborates on what impact this encounter of seeing people in their glory, seeing them as, he would say, God sees them, seeing them as not separate from him, but deeply interconnected with his own being. And one of the things that he takes away from this encounter, this experience, is that this idea, as you put it, of being a hermit, kind of on the edge of the world, being kind of tucked away in a monastery, isolated, as it were, by these walls and cloister from the rest of the world, these are fictions. He says, I'm connected. I'm not separate. My vocation is not a vocation of separateness, but it's one of relationship. And he understood his place within the church and in the world as somebody who, because of his, you know, lack of proximity to the center, to the busyness of life, to the there wasn't 24-hour news cycles in the 50s and 60s as there are today, but the hustle and bustle of things, because he was removed from that, he could see with a different perspective. He can see with a kind of clarity. I always like to quote my good friend, David Golomboski, a political theorist who also studies Merton, who once wrote a paper with the title, How Thomas Merton Pitched In by Dropping Out. And I always think that's a great way to summarize that, the sense of having a responsibility for his fellow, you know, human beings, his sisters and brothers of all kinds within humanity, regardless of tradition, regardless of race, regardless of social location, was tied to his ability to kind of be at the periphery of our society. So he was deeply a man of a man of deep prayer. He was a man who was reflective, but he was also tied to and concerned about the issues of his time, like the civil rights movement in the 50s and 60s, like peace and justice in the wake of Vietnam, and so many other important issues.
Yeah, I thought it was interesting. I read that when he first was considering his vocation, he looked at it initially as a, quote, flight from the world, and then he became more outwardly focused. And I wondered if that was, if he had a kind of a tension between those two that he, throughout his life, that he dealt with, or did he pretty much just reject the flight from the world idea?
Yeah, that's a that's an ancient idea that goes back to the desert fathers and mothers of the early centuries of Christianity in the Middle East. There's a great Latin word for what you're describing. It's fuga mundi, which sounds like some kind of insult, but I promise it's
I like that.
It's good fuga for mundi. The exactly, and that simply means fleeing, you know, fleeing the world, fuga mundi. And in the 1930s and 40s, when Merton first entered monastic life, this was the theology and spirituality. You were saying goodbye to the world. You were leaving the secular things behind, the profane things behind, and you were entering into this privileged place of prayer and reflection. And he did believe that. It was actually his abbot, which is his religious superior in the monastery, who sort of blew that up for him in his very early years as a young monk. And the reason we know him as a quasi-household name today is precisely this point. He entered the monastery thinking he would not be the novelist or the writer or the poet that he had desired to be as a young man in college. And he thought he was walking away from a writing career. But his superior, his abbot, saw in him a talent and encouraged him to continue writing. So he did write poetry, and he did write these little pamphlets about prayer, but he also wrote his spiritual autobiography known as The Seven Story Mountain. And this thing, published in the fall of 1948, becomes a kind of instant bestseller and a runaway bestseller. It's still in print today. And it's the story of his own finding faith, finding religion, discerning religious life. And so, interestingly enough, the seed of, you know, kind of inability to escape the world was planted early on in his journey. But by the time he gets into the 1950s and 60s, he's published at this point many books about the interior life, about prayer and meditation, encouraging all people to have a prayer life, right? Not just go to church on Sunday and maybe Bible study on Wednesday, but pray every day and maybe take a little time in quiet, right? And in reflection. It's a wordless prayer, as it were. And he was ahead of the game in that regard. But as much as he attended to the interior life, the spirit was pulling him as well to these concerns of his siblings outside the monastery, right, that we talked about a moment ago. He writes a letter in 1961 to his dear friend, Dorothy Day, whom I know you've had guests on this program speak about. And I'm going to paraphrase this one line, but he says to Dorothy Day, you know, I can't just write about monastic issues anymore, as important as that is. I have to write about the real issues, the life and death issues. So he felt a conviction, a part of his own vocation, to respond to these, as the Second Vatican Council and the Catholic Church called them, the signs of the times. And you can see that in the titles of the books in the last decade of his life. You know, his earliest books were things like The Sign of Jonas and New Seeds of Contemplation, Thoughts in Solitude. But in the last 10 years, he had books like Seeds of Destruction, Contemplation in a World of Action, Conjectures of a Guilty Bystander, Faith in Violence, right? So these are, you can see these themes bubbling up, but they're not separate from that earlier work or that earlier sense of longing for prayer and intimacy with God. It's really the fruit of that earlier work. So he saw these things as two sides of the same coin.
Were there particular people who were influences on him in terms of developing his views on social issues like social justice, war, racism, the environment?
Absolutely. So, you know, we mentioned one of them a moment ago, Dorothy Day. Dorothy Day, one of the co-founder of the Catholic Worker Movement. She was one of Merton's correspondents, obviously a leading figure in the peace movement, particularly during the time of the Vietnam War and during the civil rights movement of the U.S. So she was really influential. People like Jim Forrest, who was also a young Catholic Worker member, folks like the Berrigan brothers, Father Daniel Berrigan and his brother, There are others too, like Ping Ferry out in California, and folks who were involved with peace and injustice issues and protests at that time. In 1964, in fact, a bunch of these Christian peace workers or activists sought Merton's wisdom, spiritual wisdom, and invited him to lead them in a multi-day spiritual retreat. The retreat was called the Spiritual Roots of Protest. And the Berrigan brothers, Ping Ferry, Jim Forrest, John Howard Yoder, the Mennonite, a number of these leading figures of the peace movement came out to Kentucky and stayed at the Abbey of Gethsemane, where Merton gave them some reflections about how to integrate Christian belief, gospel nonviolence with the protests that they were engaged with. And so you could see that kind of two-way street influence. He was influenced by these people who were on the ground, as it were, in the cities and in the towns, fighting for peace and justice, advocating for nonviolence. And at the same time, he was encouraging them to anchor themselves in a spirit of contemplation and prayer. But it was really a mutual sort of experience. So folks like that were really important. He wrote a lot about the civil rights movement. And so he was deeply inspired by people like Martin Luther King Jr. He wrote a bit about Malcolm X. And he was in conversation with a number of folks who were seeking racial justice as well at the time. It made some of his writing on the issue of racial justice distinctive, if not unique, particularly from a white Catholic cleric. There were many white ministers of various religious traditions or Christian traditions who would march, for instance, with Dr. King. But Merton's writing was a little bit deeper and a little bit more introspective about things like white privilege and racial injustice on a structural level. So, you know, he was informed by all these different sort of streams of insight and inspiration. And and likewise, he would inform all these other folks in his own way.
Am I correct that even Joan Baez, who was known in the 60s as a protest singer, she visited him at the monastery?
She did. Yeah, he writes about that in, I think it's in December of 1966, maybe, or 1967. Yeah, she was a big fan. And his recounting is really interesting because, you know, he knew of her as this performer and activist, this singer and activist, but he didn't have a lot of young women visitors. And so that was obviously a notable encounter. And there was also like Denise Levertov and Wendell Berry. These were people, poets, who would visit Merton as well. And so folks who were very involved with, you know, the women's rights movement, somebody like Levertov, people like Wendell Berry, who's very influential in the ecological movement. Merton read Rachel Carson's Silent Spring, and that was very impactful in his own thinking about the environment. Sadly, he did that kind of in the late 60s and shortly before his unexpected death. I've often thought, if only he lived another decade, what kinds of things would he have said? What sort of integration of faith and justice would we see produced? But alas.
Was he ahead of his time, do you think, in terms of talking about things like intrinsic racism?
Yeah, I think he was. If he wasn't ahead of his time generally, he was certainly ahead of his time for folks in his own social location, by which I mean white men who are religious, white men who are religious leaders. There have been a number of folks who are anti-racist activists in the 21st century who have commented that Merton's writings still sound prophetic today. And that really is a signal of how far he was ahead of his time. But it was not just on justice issues when it comes to social justice, to civil rights. It was also in his openness to interreligious dialogue and ecumenism. He was doing this work, you know, sincerely and with passion before the Catholic Church's Second Vatican Council renewal that invited the church more broadly to engage with other traditions. At a time when Merton was welcoming Baptist ministers and seminary professors with their students to Gethsemane, this was in a time when, you know, it was oftentimes seen as inappropriate for a Catholic to enter a Protestant church, you know, to go to a cousin's wedding or something like this. It would be, you'd be seen as suspect. And so Merton was really committed to relationship, committed to encounter over the sort of what he would perceive as unjust separation, right? The injustice of strictures placed on what he saw as God's invitation to connection.
Didn't he say something like racism is a white problem? And I'm wondering if that's true, how was that kind of view on racism received by the general public? Or is there any way to tell?
Yeah, he says something along those lines in several places, probably most famously in a long essay called Letters to a White Liberal. And this was in response, it was Merton's own sort of self-implicating response after reading Dr. King's letter from Birmingham jail. So listeners may recall that Dr. Martin Luther King Jr. was in jail and was writing to religious leaders in the U.S. South, particularly white leaders, who were sympathetic to the civil rights movement and to the nonviolent methods that he was preaching, but felt at times that he was, quote unquote, going too fast, too far. And so encouraging him to kind of slow down. And so King writes this, you know, very powerful reflection and response and kind of an open letter. And it's a challenge. Merton reads this and finds himself deeply unsettled and inspired by this. And at one point in this 77-page long letter, it's called, again, Letter to a White Liberal, he says, I'm writing this so that I can explore whether or not one white man can understand this truth. And so in this reflection, he points out a number of key things. One is that, as you put it, racism is a white problem. You know, the issue is that in order for society to become more just, in order for it to be inclusive, in order from his Christian perspective for it to reflect better the reign of God that Jesus of Nazareth preached, then white people are going to have to surrender things like what today we would call privilege or security or comfort. And the other thing he says that's really cutting edge at the time as a white religious leader speaking, he says, you know, we white people, he's speaking to himself and people like him, we cannot determine the terms or the conditions under which our black siblings, our black neighbors are to be welcomed fully into this community. In other words, we have to accept our black siblings as they are and as who they are, not as we would want them to be, whatever that is. So he's very keen to emphasize that the burden, as it were, the challenge lies with white folks who have privilege and power and institutional support, and that these structures are being deployed in such a way to be sinful, to be unjust, to be harmful to our siblings, to our neighbors. And in that way, Merton was quite ahead of his time, as you said earlier. And you asked, how was it received? As you might imagine, not great. People weren't always happy about it, especially the white people like him that he was primarily addressing. If I may, just one short anecdote. The famous Protestant historian Martin Marty of the University of Chicago was pretty involved in the civil rights era with some of the marches of Dr. King and his colleagues. And he read Merton's letters to a white liberal and was enraged by it and wrote an open letter where he basically lashed out at Merton and said, who are you in the comforts of the cloister to kind of like accuse us, you know, who are out there walking in the streets, right, who are risking our lives or at least our reputations and so forth. Well, you fast forward 4 years later, this was in the early 1960s. By 1967, he writes a second open letter where he apologizes. This is published in the National Catholic Reporter. And he writes this open letter saying, I was wrong. That to talk about racism, institutional, systemic, structural racism as a white problem and not just an individual kind of sinful, aberrant sort of thing. Merton was right about this, but it took him those years of kind of having his eyes open and in deeper self-reflection to come to that point. It's a really powerful exchange, but here's somebody who on the outside of the Abbey, as it were, in the streets, took immediate offense at some of these reflections.
So did it ever bother Merton, do you think, that he wasn't able to go out and walk the streets?
That's a really great question. And one I'm not always 100% sure of. Almost immediately after Merton entered the Abbey of Gethsemane, he sort of had kind of a restlessness about him. It was oftentimes framed within the context of, I need a better place to go deeper into contemplation. He would complain often in his journals and in letters to others that the monastery's too noisy and our schedule's too busy. We're kind of running from the chapel or running out to the farm or running over to the dining room or doing this or doing that. And he's like, I need to slow down. Isn't that what this is supposed to be about? So, you know, he keeps researching these other monastic communities like the Carthusians and the Camaldolese out in the West Coast near Big Sur in California. And he says, you know what? That's what I need to do. I need to transfer into another community. Or I need to do this, I need to do that. And the wisdom of his superiors at the time really shined through because they said they wouldn't allow it. They wouldn't let him kind of pursue these transferring paths. They did on occasion allow him to have a few exceptions. So one of those was to spend in the late 1950s through the early 1960s, a portion of his day in a kind of temporary hermitage. I mean, to be honest, it was a glorified tool shed that he named St. Anne's, but it was a little space kind of out in the woods, a little bit removed from the kind of day in and day out activities of the monastery, where he could read and he can write and he could pray. By 1965, he's given permission from the abbot to live full time in a hermitage that was constructed. And this was basically a cinder block kind of, you know, two room sort of house. To call the house is actually a little bit of an exaggeration, but a little garage, what you might imagine. And he lived there the rest of his life until his Asian journey.
Our guest today on A Better World is Daniel Horan, professor of philosophy, religious studies, and theology at St. Mary's College in Notre Dame. He's a columnist also for the National Catholic Reporter. And you're listening to us on A Better World at 103.7 WPVM in Asheville, North Carolina, and we're streaming live at WPVMFM.org. And we'll be back with Dan in just a few minutes after this break. Okay, that's the choir of Merton College, conducted by Benjamin Nichols. The song is Mother of God, Here I Stand, and that's the album is the Marian Collection. And today we are talking to Daniel Horan, professor of philosophy, religious studies, and theology at St. Mary's College, and he's also an expert on the life and works of Thomas Merton. I wanted to, before we move on from the racism issue and that he addressed, I found this quote that I thought was apropos kind of to what you were talking about. He might have written this or said it in 1964, and it goes as follows. Most of us are congenitally unable to think black, and yet that is precisely what we must do before we can hope to understand the crisis in which we find ourselves. I guess one point I wanted to make is that crisis still is in existence, and it doesn't seem to have abated very much, although I think probably more people are aware of the issue today.
Yeah, that's absolutely true. I mean, this is another instance in which Merton could have written that in 2026 or in 2020, if we think about the summer of the Black Lives Matter movement. and the backlash to that, right? So I think what Merton is saying there in that quote you share points to a kind of a persistent struggle that white folks like myself, like Merton in particular, have to be conscious of, right? Because otherwise we find ourselves slipping back into a sense of normativity, a sense of projection that the way that I think, the way that I move through the world, the way that I live is the way that everybody else does. And so when he says, you know, we are unable to think black, we're unable to think in a way, and the we here, of course, he's talking about white folks like him, we're unable to imagine what it's like to be in somebody else's shoes, right? So it's something deeper than empathy here, because it is about a recognition of the inherent dignity and value of all people, and that their experience, that their journey, that their way of thinking, their culture, all kinds of things that are oftentimes derided or subjugated or viewed in opposition to a sort of white normativity. These are things that are hurdles for lots of white folks, right? So I think we see that, you know, in the civil rights movements of and demonstrations of the 1960s, you know, which were like, you know, the echoes are really are striking, like the largely nonviolent movements and protests of the Black Lives Matter demonstrations in 2020. These things were, there's this kind of a pushback that comes culturally, that comes politically, that comes through law enforcement. And, you know, Merton was attuned to that. And I think what you see in his writings, what you see in his exhortations to his fellow white folks is we have to do some deep reflection internally. We have to change our way of thinking. We have to learn without demanding. We need to listen without setting the terms and needing to be in control. And that is a very hard thing to do when you've been in a position or part of a community for which power and control has been the norm for almost ever.
Let me switch gears just a second. You mentioned earlier about his communication with Dorothy Day, who was a big advocate against war. And I wanted to ask you his views on war. We are engaged in a war now in between the United States and Iran. There's wars in the Middle East and in Africa. What is the gist of his? He wrote a book, I think it was not released until 2004, Peace in the Post-Christian Era. And I guess one of my questions is, why was it censored by his superiors in 1962? And what, tell us kind of the summary of that book. Does that cover his views on war?
It's a really great collection of his thoughts on war and nonviolence. So I commend our listeners to check that out. Briefly, it was condemned, you're right with the date, 1962, the early 1960s, not just his American religious superiors, but what is known as the Abbot General, sort of the, like, you know, the Pope of the Trappists, you know, just beneath the Pope, as it were, in Rome, who oversaw all members, all the monks of the Trappist order around the world. He stepped in and said, essentially, Merton should not write anymore about issues of war and violence. There was a lot of pushback to Merton's writings on peace and his anti-war writings. Part of this was not unlike what would come up a year or two later from Martin Marty on his racial writings, which is that people felt it was unbecoming of a cloistered monk, a Roman Catholic priest, to comment on these things. Now, to some of us, that might sound outrageous. It sounds outrageous to me, but then again, you know, I'm a columnist at National Catholic Reporter. So I write about these things very publicly all the time. But in the 50s and 60s, this was seen as inappropriate. What's interesting is that he was not prohibited from writing. He wasn't deeply censored about writing on issues of race. And so he was permitted, you would think today, like, oh, that would be a hot button issue that maybe the religious superiors would want to avoid. So in any event, he is forbidden from any kind of public commentary on war and violence, but he starts circulating letters and collects these letters that he sends to others. These become mimeographed and then get passed along. Eventually, they're published after his death as the Cold War letters. But he always finds a way to kind of offer his reflections, partly because people are writing to him like a Dorothy Day, like a Jim Forrest, asking for his insights, asking for some wisdom or perspective. But that book, piece in a post-Christian era, there are a number of chapters in there where you do get a good synthesis of Merton's thought on what is the Christian's response to war. And he has several chapters on, it's very timely today because this has been a topic in the news in recent weeks, particularly with Pope Leo and some of his, the folks in political office who are kind of attacking him or fighting with him, as it were, this theme of just war theory. It is a longstanding moral principle in the Catholic tradition that goes all the way back to St. Augustine. And there are a number of criteria that have to be met in order from a Catholic moral perspective to claim that the violent use of force by a state is justified in an ethical way. And one of the things that Merton lays out is this belief. He wants to maintain that kind of church teaching that's on the books. He doesn't want to kind of throw it out. So he's very careful to never kind of move outside of orthodoxy. But he does say, he says, theoretically, we could imagine a situation where a defensive use of violent force is justified. You know, you might think of something like the Ukrainian people responding to an invasion from Russia or something like that. However, Merton says, with the kind of technology we have today, and he's writing in the 1960s, with the kind of, particularly after World War II and the dropping of the bomb on Hiroshima and Nagasaki, where there's always the threat of escalation to total annihilation of the world, can there ever be a use of military force that's justified? And he basically answers that with no. So he remains somebody who theoretically upholds the just war principles, but says that in practice, this is impossible in our current age. I would say with drone strikes and with cyber attacks and with all AI today, like, it's only gotten worse, right? And so Merton would probably double down on his position from the 60s. And I think that's really insightful, because where that leaves him is in a position to say that, you know, from a Christian perspective, God incarnate, you know, always spoke against the use of force, telling Peter to put away the sword in the Garden of Gethsemane, kind of not putting up a violent defensive resistance to his own wrongful execution, you know, saying things in the canonical gospels like those who live by the sword will die by the sword, and to turn the other cheek and to love one's enemies. And so what Merton says is, the vocation to Christian nonviolence is part of what it means to be for everyone. It is not a selective thing like a conscientious objector. This is part and parcel of what it means to be a member of the baptized. And so obviously not everybody agrees with that. I think there are some folks who are world leaders today who would not take kindly to that sort of thing. I think Pope Leo understands a little bit of what that kind of response might look like. But that's really where Merton fell. He was very convicted about this. Peace was the only way. Nonviolence was the Christian way.
Not only were his writings prophetic, but it also shows how little things have changed since he was alive and writing about these issues. Let me ask you about his interest in, because he was also interested in, advocated also for the natural world. Was his involvement in writing to these issues, was that indicative of, say, the Jesuit influence on his life or St. Francis's influence on his life?
Well, as somebody who wrote a whole book about the Franciscan influence on his theology and spirituality, I certainly would affirm the Franciscan influence on his thinking. But there's also a Benedictine tradition of care for the earth and for the location. You know, one of the things that Catholic monks and nuns who are of the Benedictine tradition, as Merton was as a Trappist, that they are committed to is what's called stability, right? It's a vow of place. They're committed to this particular place. So to be cultivators and caretakers of the place, the monastery grounds, for instance, where they will spend their whole life until their death, is rooted back in all the way to the rule of Saint Benedict in the sixth century CE. So there are a number of kind of factors that inform Merton's thinking. What is interesting, what I can say for sure, is that there is this kind of lifelong interest in attraction, kind of a magnetic attraction he has to the more than human world. It's striking if you look at his journal entries going back to the early 1940s, all the way up until his death in the 1960s. He's often writing about non-human animal kind of observations or reflections on the environment. He has some beautiful passages. One comes to mind very early on in his book, Sign of Jonas, which is oftentimes thought of as like the sequel to Seven Story Mountain. It's basically edited versions of a early monastic journal he kept. But one night, it's late summer evening. He's lying in his bed in his monastery cell, and he can hear out in the pond, a few yards from where he's sleeping, these frogs doing their kind of frog sounds, right? They're kind of talking to each other. Maybe they're frog mating calls or something to this effect. But he has this beautiful reflection about how, in hearing this, what he calls chorus of these animals, these frogs, that they're giving praise to God in a way that supplements and kind of reflects the monks who just a few hours earlier were praising God in song in their choir, in their chanting of the Psalms. And so, you know, it's oftentimes not deeply systematic, but we have these little nuggets, these little seeds of interest in and care for creation and a closeness to the more than human world.
You're listening to A Better World at 103.7 WPVM in Asheville, North Carolina. And our guest today is Dan Horan, Professor of Philosophy, Religious Studies, and Theology at St. Mary's College. Okay, that's Joe Satriani playing Cryin from his album, The Extremists. Dan, there was I guess this is more of a philosophical question, but Thomas Merton wrote and talked about this idea of a true self versus a false self. Can you kind of give us, sorry, we're in the last quarter of the hour, but can you give us kind of an idea of what he meant by that?
I'll do my best in as brief as possible an opportunity as I can take, because this is an ongoing debate among scholars of Merton and spiritual scholars and theologians. In its most basic form, I would say that Merton understood the true self to be who each person is in the eyes of God, that God loved each person into existence, so that God doesn't primarily love humanity in general. Like, we get that sometimes from a particular reading of Genesis 1, where like, and now God creates humans, and now God creates the day and the night, and now God creates kind of in these generic ways. But for Merton, he was more drawn to maybe that second creation account in Genesis 2, where God's playing in the dirt, creates human beings, ha-adama, from the dust of the earth, and breathes life into them. That there's this kind of intimacy and knowledge of each and every single person. And so with that, Merton believed that God knew, not just intellectually, but in a profoundly existential way, who each of us are. We are loved into existence, as it were, and that God knew us in our most intimate, authentic sense or self. This is what he called the true self. However, we spend most of our time doubting the goodness of the true self, doubting our ability to be liked or loved by God. In one book of his called The New Man, he has an extended reflection on the Genesis 3 story of Adam and Eve and the snake and the tree of knowledge of good and evil and all of this. And what he says is essentially the false self arises because we don't believe that we're inherently good enough. The temptation of the snake to Eve and to Adam is you could be something else. You could be something more. You could be like God. That you're, the implication is you're not good enough as you are. You could be better. And so much of our time, of our energy is trying to be something other than who we are, to be a better self or to be, you know, perceived or liked or to adopt to some sort of script that we expect the world is projecting onto us and so on and so on. And so we manifest these illusory selves, as Burton says, these false selves. I think in the age of social media, where people are kind of putting filters on Instagram and this, that, and the other, you have this kind of curation of a self. You have a digital false self now. And what Merton says is the only way you find out who you really are is by discovering God. He says we discover ourselves in discovering God. He writes that in the book New Seeds of Contemplation. And he says the way we discover God is through contemplation, through prayer. And I think it's so relevant today because we're so busy and so distracted and things are so noisy that silence is scary. quiet time is scary. The idea of not filling it with all kinds of noise or distractions is very scary, but yet that's the only way, Merton says. And so that, in a nutshell, I think is what the true self is, an invitation to discover God and to discover who we are in the eyes of God.
One last theological question, if I could. He talked about how Christians, the vocation of every Christian was to be an instrument of unity. And I look at some of the work of the Christian community, in especially in America today, and that's the one I see mostly of, we're a far cry from that, being an instrument of unity. Can you just talk briefly about what he saw that role? And
yeah, you know, it's true. One of the things that he said in a lecture that he gave just a few weeks before he died, he was in Calcutta, India, speaking to a group of monks and nuns. And he ended his reflection with this really powerful kind of call to action, I would say, or kind of inspirational sort of message. He says, "We are already one, but we imagine that we are not. And what we have to recover is our original unity. What we have to be is what we are." And for me, this notion of original unity, he says a little bit earlier in that essay and in that address that he gives, that we are kind of distracted by these illusions of separateness. We come up with all kinds of reasons to ignore or to overlook the truth that we have this original unity, that we are meant to be in community and in communion with one another. And so in that regard, I think Merton had this profound, it was an existential thing, it was a spiritual thing. But I think for him, it was also a practical thing, that if we could see past these illusions, these sort of distractions that we use to justify our separateness, we could resolve things like violence. We could resolve things like racial injustice. We can resolve things like environmental degradation, because we would recognize that we are part of something larger than ourselves and called to that relationship.
Can you tell us about the International Thomas Merton Society and the Thomas Merton Center, in case there's people out there that are interested in knowing more?
Absolutely. So the ITMS, as we call it, the International Thomas Merton Society, is an organization that was founded several decades ago, initially of Merton scholars, people who were engaged in research on Merton's life and writings, but quickly grew to include lots of folks who are what we like to call Merton enthusiasts, people who love to read Merton, who are inspired by him, who like to hear about Merton, to share ideas. And so there are the International Thomas Merton Society is the sort of umbrella organization, but there are local chapters of the Merton Society in cities all around the United States and Canada. And if you go to Merton.org, you can learn more about the ITMS, these local chapters where people meet to have a book club or to hear, you know, talks or presentations on Merton and Merton's wisdom. And then the Merton Center, which you can also learn about at that same website, Merton.org, is the academic repository of Merton's archives. And that's housed at Bellarmine University in Louisville, Kentucky. And it was Merton himself who established this archive in the last years of his life, 1966, 1967, and decided that that would be the home for his manuscripts and his correspondence. And so all things Merton you can find there. It's directed by Dr. Paul Pearson, and the assistant archivist is Mark Mead, and they are just wonderful researchers and incredibly helpful people. And if you're ever in Louisville, go to Bellarmine University and look them up. They would gladly show you around and show you a number of things of Merton's.
There's so much to Thomas Merton, his life and his works. We only kind of skimmed the surface today, but I want to thank Daniel Horan for coming on the show and sharing with us about Thomas Merton. Dan, all the best to you, and thanks again.
Thank you.
You've been listening to A Better World at 103.7 WPVM in Asheville, North Carolina. This is McNair Ezard. Thank you for joining us, and hopefully we'll see you next time on A Better World. And we're going out today with Lucius Flux out of Atlanta singing Love Still Remains.